This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Big cities in every part of the country have seen a spike in murders this year, including Hartford. The capital city had 19 homicides in all of 2014. That number was matched by July 27th this year. Meanwhile, highly visible mass killings seem to be part of everyday life now. ISIS executions on social media, worshippers murdered in a Charleston church, and the horrifying live TV murders of a news crew in Virginia. It's far too soon to know the cause for the uptick in violence, but increasingly researchers and clinicians are wondering, is violence like a contagious disease that can't easily be stopped? Are we entering a more deadly period of shootings, and can we turn this trend around? Join our conversation on WNPR.org/where we live. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We're joined in studio today by Dr. Hank Schwartz, psychiatrist-in-chief at Hartford Hospital's Institute of Living and vice president of behavioral health at Hartford Healthcare. Dr. Schwartz, welcome back to Where We Live.
Well, thanks for having me.
We started talking to you just shortly after the terrible shootings that we all saw in Virginia, live television, a news crew murdered by people who, or by a man who knew them. I'm wondering if you, when you saw that, if you felt like there was something different going on, if we'd entered some sort of a new phase in this watch of violence that we've both been on for such a long time now.
I do think we have entered a new phase, and I think that contagion is a good model for talking about it. You know, a contagion is a phenomena in which one event spurs additional events through a variety of means. You can think of infectious disease as the model for it, but in this instance, the contagion, I think, is fueled by disinhibition, which is to say that the more an individual sees these kinds of incidents, and we're seeing them, you know, all the time, the more the incident becomes acceptable. And angry, unstable individuals become disinhibited by viewing these sorts of things. And then as the disinhibition leads to a greater ability to engage in the act. I'm not suggesting that this is a conscious process, by the way. I think if you imagine a world in which there were no shootings on the media of any kind, people would, by and large, not be thinking about shooting. Then imagine that over a period of a month, there are scores of shootings. The idea occurs to people. Its presence in the media comes to seem more and more acceptable. And so the inhibitions that keep people from acting in this way are gradually eroded, of course, in only in vulnerable individuals.
I'm wondering if you can talk a bit more about that through the lens of your practice and the patients that you've seen for so many years. This idea of disinhibition makes a lot of practical sense to those of us who watch it in the media, right? The more we see violence, the more violence might occur to people. We hear about copycat shootings, and we've heard about that for years. But from a psychological standpoint, can you explain a little bit about how that actually works in the brain?
Sure. You know, we've seen this for generations. We've been aware that this happens with individuals committing suicide, particularly young people. And so we know with regard to suicide that there actually is likely a biologic predisposition, which in some instances, which we think of as genetic, and yet the genetics and biological influences are never quite enough. You need environmental influences and things that happen in your life to supersede and impact on one's underlying predispositions. And so with unstable people, we have people who are more prone to impulsiveness, less capable of dealing with their anger and their irritability, and acting out becomes attractive once you see it occurring increasingly frequently.
Of course, a big piece of this that we've discussed in the past is the easy, relatively in America, easy access to guns. If you have both this disposition and also the means to carry out an act, it works differently on an individual than if you perhaps are predisposed to violence, but you don't have any tool with which to cause violence.
So there's absolutely no question that this violence is related to access to guns. We know from from studies of the incidence of both mental illness across developed nations and the incidence of gun violence, that the incidence of mental illness is fairly stable. Take a disease like schizophrenia. It's roughly 1% across all developed countries. But the incidence of gun violence goes up dramatically as access to guns goes up. And so the presence of the weapon has an extraordinary effect on the impulsive person. We know that people thinking about suicide, studies have demonstrated, people thinking about shooting themselves, if you take that gun and secure it in the critical few moments when that impulse to kill yourself is upon you, lives are saved.
We're talking with Dr. Hank Schwartz from Hartford Healthcare and the Institute of Living. We're talking about violence as a contagion. It's a relatively new idea that many researchers are looking at, including Dr. Sherry Towers, who's a research professor at the Simon A. Levin Mathematical, Computational, and Modeling Sciences Center at Arizona State University. Dr. Towers joins us by phone today. Sherry Towers, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if you can talk about what got you interested in the idea of looking at violence as a type of contagion.
Well, my collaborators and I do a lot of contagion modeling of diseases in general. But I personally got the idea to do this analysis actually from an event in my own life. I was due to have a meeting at Purdue University in January of 2014, and the meeting was unfortunately canceled because there had been a school shooting on campus. A student had walked into a lecture hall and shot dead another student. And it occurred to me that day that was, I believe, something like the third school shooting I had heard about in about a 10-day period. And I thought, is this just a statistical fluke that there has been this many over, you know, about a week-long period? Or is there something much more complicated underlying dynamics where perhaps one of these other school shootings may have ideated the Purdue school shooter to do what he did through news reports, for instance?
So as you began looking at this, what did you find? Tell us about the statistical modeling that you put together, and tell us about what you found here.
So what we did is when we embarked upon the study, we found it extraordinarily difficult to find data. There is a funding embargo on federal funding embargo on studies like ours. And so really there is no federal database of these kind of events. So what we had to do was to go to private organizations who collect this kind of data and ask them for their data. So we used data from the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence on mass shootings and school shootings. And we also have another data set that we obtained from USA Today that is mass shootings where there's at least three people shot, not necessarily killed. So what we did is we looked at each of these data sets separately, and what we found is in the, we would call them, I guess, refer to them as kind of like low impact events. So there were several people shot, not very many people killed. Those typically were local news stories. Those did not appear to be contagious. But if you looked at the higher impact events where there were many more people killed, or if it was a school shooting, then those tended to get national media attention. Those showed evidence of contagion. They showed that there was evidence that when a mass killing occurred, it temporarily increased the probability of a similar event occurring in the near future. And the hallmark of that is that you would see unusual clustering in time of these kinds of events, and that is indeed exactly what we saw.
So in part, your findings echo some of what Hank Schwartz said, that the media coverage of these events certainly does play a very large role.
It does play a role. I think one thing you have to keep in mind, though, is that one of the other things that we saw in our study, we posit that plays a role just based on that study. We haven't proved it yet, but it's certainly something to look at. One of the other things we noticed in our study is that the per capita rates of school shootings, mass killings are far higher in states that have a higher prevalence of firearm ownership. So more guns, the greater the risk that these kind of events will happen. But another thing I'd like to point out is that Canadians, I'm Canadian, I immigrated here 18 years ago, and Canadians are largely live along just north of the U.S. border, and our exposure to U.S. television is quite high. Many Canadians actually will watch the U.S. news in the evenings, and so Canadians are just as exposed to the violent messages, you know, related to these kind of tragic events, as their Americans just south of the border are, and yet the likelihood that they will act upon any kind of ideated impulse is much, much, much lower than it is here, and many times lower, actually, than it is here in the U.S. So clearly, beyond just firearms, beyond just exposure to media, there's more going on in our society that's causing these things that I really think needs more study.
Hank Schwartz, I'm wondering if you could give us some comment on this study and what maybe conclusions you're drawing from it.
Well, I just want to add to that last comment that I believe that Canadians do not have the same per capita gun ownership that we have in America. So the difference may not be extreme, but guns, I think, probably do play a role here. Well, I think this study is very important in that it provides a mathematical model to establish that images, perhaps, granted not proven, but it is the suspected cause, that images of violence and news about gun violence acts in the same vector-like fashion that a virus might act in to lead to the next steps and what seems like almost exponential growth of these violent episodes that we're experiencing.
Sherry, I just have to ask you about the federal funding embargo and how big a role you think that this plays. We've been hearing for years that the Centers for Disease Control can't study gun violence in the way it might study other contagions. Do you have a sense that this plays into the ongoing lack of understanding about this problem, that we just don't study it as we would some other sort of contagious disease?
It absolutely does. When I pitched the idea to my colleagues that this might be an interesting analysis to look at, part of that discussion involved the fact that we would have no funding to do it, that this would have to be something that we would have to find time in our spare time, essentially, to do this study, which is exactly what we did, because we really just couldn't, even if we wanted grant funding, we couldn't even apply for it. So I think that most researchers are busy with their research program, and to just put aside time to do analyses for free, essentially, or, you know, in your spare time, is not an option for many researchers because, you know, you have to publish on your main topic of research regularly in order to, you know, move along in the academic system. And I think what we did was a little bit unusual in that we did do this in our spare time because we were interested.
We're talking with Dr. Sherry Towers from Arizona State University and Dr. Hank Schwartz from Hartford's Institute of Living. We're talking about violence as a contagion. We're going to be talking more about the sudden uptick, it seems, in violence across America in urban areas. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. There's been an uptick in violence across the country this year, including in the city of Hartford. What's happening across America? Many researchers and clinicians are wondering whether or not violence, whether it's mass shootings or urban gun violence, is some sort of a contagion, whether or not we can treat it like we might treat another disease. We're talking with Dr. Hank Schwartz, psychiatrist in chief at Hartford Hospital's Institute of Living, who's in studio with us. Dr. Sherry Towers is on the phone with us from Arizona State University. Also joining us now from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. is Daniel Webster, director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and research and deputy director for research, Johns Hopkins Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence. Daniel Webster, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
I'm wondering what you see in this recent uptick in violence as we see more murders in cities across America. There's a lot of reasons that police and others are giving. What do you see in this recent rise?
Well, first of all, I think that we should be cautious in thinking that we have a nationwide huge upsurge in violence. In selected cities, they're clearly, certainly in the city in which I work, in Baltimore, we've had a historic rise in gun violence, and there's a few other cities seeing sharp increases as well. It's as a researcher, it's good to sort of, at least I try to think about long-term trends. We don't know if this is a long-term trend. This is a short increase. As has been discussed just previously, what concerns me is the contagion phenomenon. Gun violence is a problem that, if not addressed rapidly, can easily escalate as one shooting leads to another and another, whether through a process of retaliation or social norms, fear, and all of that generating more widespread illegal gun carrying.
Daniel, do you see contagion in urban violence that we've been reporting on in a place like Baltimore or in Hartford, Connecticut? Do you see that in some ways related to the idea of contagion around mass shootings or school shootings or periodic clusters of suicides? Do you see this as part of the same phenomenon, or is it in your mind something different?
Well, I don't think it's connected specifically to those events. I do think that the process, at least some of the process, is similar just with respect to mimicry, the importance of social norms, type of behavior or responding to conflicts and confrontations by grabbing a gun. That is a normal, reasonable thing to do. Yes, that sort of process occurs both in the context of mass shootings, suicides, and in urban gun violence. But I think that there are certainly some more unique aspects of gun violence. I suspect that young men in East Baltimore near my campus, what dictates their behavior is probably has less to do what they might see about a shooting in middle America at a school than it is of what's going on in their block, in their particular neighborhood.
Hank Schwartz?
You know, of course, all of these shootings are multifactorial, and the motives will vary from individual to individual. But I believe that there is a common denominator between urban violence that we're seeing, which may be individual to individual, and mass shootings and school shootings. And this gets to the motive of the shooter. And the belief that one's injured feelings are more important than the life of another, I think, must be a consistent common denominator. Granted, some shootings are just completely impulsive and not thought out, and the shooter may actually regret the event. On the whole, the loss, the diminution of the value of life as the value of acting out and seeking vindication for one's injuries, I think, pervades both individual shootings and mass shootings. That vindication, the sense of vindication, is an important motive for individuals who feel as though they have suffered enormous injustice. Mass shooters, by and large, are injustice collectors, and the opportunity to shoot in visible and public ways, the more visible and public, the greater the sense of vindication. The greater the opportunity to have that heroic moment, it may seem absurd to us to think that the notoriety that attaches to that moment could feel to the individual shooter as a moment of almost public fame or at least acknowledgement of injury. But we know from the mass shooters who survive, and there are few enough of them, that is an important element in their motivation. And yes, I'm hypothesizing that it's an important element in the motivation of individual shooters in urban areas.
You talk about empowering the powerless, that the gun is a tool that gives someone who feels as though, for whatever reason, their power has been taken away, whether that's in a mass shooting situation or in some sort of a one-on-one violence situation, that tool itself provides a type of power that then may lead to the violent act.
Yes, it provides a power over other people and an opportunity for almost instantaneous and immediate gratification with that sense of vindication. And now we're seeing, as this actually can occur live on television and be tweeted and spread out through social media to the entire world, that the vindication is occurring on a world stage.
Daniel Webster, I'm wondering if you could pick up on that, this idea of the gun as a tool for the powerless. And again, that's one way in which this notion can stretch across the many different types of gun violence that we're seeing in America today.
Well, I find myself nodding my head to much of what Dr. Schwartz was just saying with respect to a motive and a mindset of a vindication, and that the gun clearly serves as the empowering tool to seek that vindication. And that definitely is present in much urban gun violence, just as it is in these other contexts of mass shootings.
You know, you can think of this attitude that your sense of injury is worth more than the life of another as a form of extreme narcissism. But, you know, I'd argue that it goes beyond narcissism to solipsism. Solipsism is the concept that you are the only thing that is real, that the people around you aren't real, that they're really just props there as the background for your own life. And if they're just props, if you're angry and if killing them can achieve a kind of vindication, and if that vindication can be public, bringing you fame, which we would think of as notoriety, then why not kill? They're just cardboard props.
Given that, though, I wonder if that rubs up against in any way the notion of violence like this as a contagion. If you have individuals who see themselves as the center of a world in which everyone else is a cardboard figure, how much are they able to place themselves within the scope of humanity that is looking at violence day after day after day and saying that I want to be part of that myself? Did you take my point that if you're so narcissistic that the world is about you, are you truly feeding off of a surge in violence as a contagious act amongst others, or is it really just an inner life that you have that suggests pulling the trigger is the best way to calm whatever fears or worries that you might have?
Oh, I think the concepts go quite well together. And we have to remember how complex our psychologies are and how many impulses and themes are operating at the same time. So it's completely consistent, I think, to be completely self-involved, to value yourself and your own feelings more than the life of another, but also to be influenced by the means of seeking that kind of vindication as you are exposed to them. You know, a generation or two ago, people sought this kind of vindication with their fists. Now they see that guns are available. People can use them. Why not use them?
Daniel Webster, this is something that we hear from police chiefs around our state, certainly, and around America. This is a feeling that they have that individual beefs may have once been settled on the playground with fists, and now they're being settled with guns. It seems in some ways a simplistic formula, but it's one that is also being played out in many, many cities. Do you buy this as one of the causes?
Well, certainly, yes. So many of these shootings, at least that occur in a place like Baltimore, you know, start off with sometimes very minor altercations. And if a gun isn't readily available at that time, punches are thrown. But the norm then becomes someone got the better of you in the fisticuffs, then your next move is to ratchet it up, access a gun and use that in retaliation. But we've been seeing this, sadly, for a very long time. When I first started studying the problem back in the late 1980s and early 1990s, we had rates of gun homicide that were twice what we're seeing right now. So this has been around clearly at least for a generation. You can go back even to the early 80s. There was a spike then as well. So sadly, in the United States, we've made guns way too available to people who shouldn't have access to them, and tried to solve this problem simply as thinking of this as a criminal justice problem. If you put enough people in jail, this will all go away. The incarceration effect may have a very minor and temporary protective effect. But now if you look at communities in cities like Baltimore, you have very large numbers of individuals who can't get jobs, and that also is the root of some of these squabbles. People literally are killing each other over very small amounts of money, and that's part of it as well.
Daniel Webster, we just have 2 minutes with you left. Do you have any sort of prescription for this? I mean, what's one thing that you would do to help make this problem better?
Well, I think we have to invest wholeheartedly in focusing on the two things that come together in these shootings. One is easy access to a gun, and ways to resolve these conflicts that don't involve shooting others. So there are programs that I've studied and others have studied where you do street outreach to the high-risk individuals. You help with conflict mediation and resolution skills. And when done well, this dramatically reduces shootings. We also find that policing that is focused in a very narrow way in the most violent individuals and most violent places to make it much more risky to pick up a gun, there again, we see pretty consistent reductions in shooting. So we get distracted, in my opinion, in part fighting the drug war that really, if anything, has only made the problem worse. And we really should be focusing on what this is. We have a problem with illegal guns, and we have a problem with social norms that make it all too acceptable to reach for those guns when someone has wronged you.
Daniel Webster is director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research and deputy director for research at the Johns Hopkins Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence. He joined us today from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Daniel Webster, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I want to go back to Dr. Sherry Towers briefly and ask, what is next in your research? And if you have any prescriptions or ideas that have come out of some of what you've learned about violence as a contagion?
One of the things we would like to look at, and actually indeed has been looked at before, is whether or not gang violence, so gang-related shootings, are contagious. Because, for instance, you can have this effect of there's a shooting and then there's retaliatory shooting. We want to do the same sort of mathematical model as we use in the mass shooting analysis. But the benefit in that particular context is that if you have that model that describes those dynamics, then you can look at that model and see how best you would be able to control gang shootings. Because certainly much of the shootings that have been happening this summer that have caused this incredible spike have been gang-related, and that is something that we need to understand more about. So our next step is to actually look at Chicago, gang shootings in Chicago, and try to see if we see evidence of contagion in those.
Dr. Sherry Towers is research professor at the Simon A. Levin Mathematical Computational Modeling Sciences program at Arizona State University. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time, and I very much appreciate your research.
Thank you.
Dr. Schwartz, you want to jump in?
Just want to touch on the issue of the relationship between mental illness and violence because they are so often conflated. I think it's important to point out that there's no indication that the rise in homicides that we're seeing in urban areas is particularly related to mental illness. And just to remind the audience, as we've said in the past, that even the mass shootings and school shootings are perpetrated fewer than 50% of the time by individuals with mental illness. That being said, and it's also important to note, I think, that the kind of motives that we're talking about, this belief, this sort of narcissistically rooted belief in the importance of one's own feeling, does relate to a kind of social disconnectedness and a lack of empathic capacity that often is detected early in the life of individuals. And so social emotional learning programs in schools as early as grammar school are a very, very long-term influence, and certainly they're only going to address a part of the problem, but important.
Well, and also interesting, though, too, that you bring it back to, if you're talking about social norms and narcissism and the way it actually plays out in behavior, that may not be mental illness in the same category as schizophrenia that a mass shooter may have, but it's in its own way mental illness and something that needs to be treated in America at a slightly different level than perhaps we are treating it.
I'd like to think of it as instability. These are unstable individuals. We could redefine mental illness if we wanted simply by saying, well, look, anybody who can pick up a gun, who's unstable enough to pick up a gun and shoot somebody else, is mentally ill. But that's not the way that we define it. We think of it as an aberrant behavior. And so I think we really need another way to think about or talk about or perhaps classify these kinds of individuals and the instability that they experience that could lead them to shoot other than formal mental illness diagnosis.
Keith is calling from Glastonbury. Hello, Keith. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, John. Interesting conversation here. But one thing I think is never taken into consideration enough is the magnitude of the problem in the U.S. When you look at 34,000 deaths with a very high incidence of suicide, and if you lay that alongside the UK, which is probably an extreme example, and the other end of the scale, and you level the populations, it's a ratio of almost 40 to 1, 34,000 versus 800. I realize that's not contagion directly, but it seems to be a comparison that's under-addressed and the underlying problems are not looked at enough.
Keith, first of all, thank you very much for bringing that up. And Hank Schwartz is certainly, these are numbers that we've talked about on our program before. And, I mean, if we talk about violence as a contagion, you know, America has caught a really bad case and the rest of the world seems to not have the sniffles. And there's a lot in that, but Keith's right. I mean, we have this very badly, and the numbers bear it out.
Absolutely, and we have demonstrated contagion in young people in school, high school age, and even college age. But clearly, a very, very significant number of suicides occur by gun, and clearly, a very significant number of suicides are impulsive. Many are well planned, but some are impulsive. The higher the lethality of the means of suicide in combination with impulsivity means that in countries that have very great access to guns, you will have far more completed suicides. And that is an issue for America.
Is the ideation of suicide, is it like in your mind, is it like the same notion someone might have to pick up a gun and shoot another? I mean, how are they related?
I think actually in general it's very different. The destruction of the self as opposed to destruction of another requires – destruction of another requires a whole set of values or devaluation of the other, whereas destruction of the self is devaluation of the self that simply doesn't hurt another. So I think they're very different issues except – in many mass shootings, because we see that many mass shootings actually are suicides in intent with massive collateral damage. And the collateral damage and the suicide sit side by side. Who knows which exactly is more important? But in those incidents, they're very closely related.
But both of these, though, require in some ways a notion that something in your life is so terrible, whether it's a wrong that someone has imposed on you, a beef on a schoolyard, or whether or not you feel as though the world is coming down on you, or if you feel as though your life is worthless. These are all some of the same triggers, perhaps?
Yes, but feeling as though your life is worthless really is a variant of your own failure.
Yeah.
Many, many people who kill themselves feel they have failed desperately. The outside world may conspire against them, but they've been unable to achieve whatever it takes to live a reasonable and satisfying and happy life. That is very, very different, I think, from the projection onto others as the source of all of the terrible things that have happened to your life, which can then enrage you sufficiently to feel that you are entitled to take a life.
Mm. Dr. Hank Schwartz, a psychiatrist in chief at Hartford Hospital's Institute of Living. He joins us in the studio to talk about violence as a contagion. When we come back from a break, we're going to be talking with someone who's been looking at this for some time and trying to solve the problem of violence as a contagion. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, Colin McEnroe will switch seats with me. He'll guest host our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. Hope you can join Colin for the special show. We're talking today about violence as a contagious disease. It's a new way of looking at violence. And we're talking with Dr. Hank Schwartz today, psychiatrist in chief at Hartford Hospital's Institute of Living and vice president of behavioral health at Hartford Healthcare. We'll take more of your phone calls in a moment. We want to turn, though, to someone who's been looking at this for some time and trying to solve the problem of violence by treating it as a disease. Gary Slutkin is founder and executive director of Cure Violence. He's professor of epidemiology and international health at the University of Illinois at Chicago School of Public Health. Gary, welcome to our program. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, John. I'm happy to be with you.
You've been successful in combating contagious diseases like AIDS and in countries like Uganda. What makes you think that gun violence is in a similar class as some of these other diseases?
Yeah, you're right, John. I'm an infectious disease doctor by training, and I've been working on these other epidemic diseases for about half of my career. And I began to, I moved back to the United States in 1995, having been in Africa for 10 years. And it struck me that, and this is in 1995, 96, that when I was looking at charts and graphs and maps, it was, they were the same types of charts and graphs and maps as I had been working on with cholera or AIDS or tuberculosis or anything like it, the same typical epidemic type of waves, same type of clustering. And then when I started to explore and ask what is the greatest risk factor for a violent event, the answer was a preceding violent event. And that's the same answer for what is the greatest predictor of a case of flu, a preceding case of flu, or a cold, or TB, or cholera, and so on. And in fact, those are those three characteristics, the types of waves, the clustering, and the fact that there is transmission. Is what characterizes this as any disease as contagious. And we now even know, and Dr. Schwartz has been brilliant on elucidating some of the mechanisms for this that are as described psychologically, but we now know a lot of some of the brain processes. In other words, the brain is processing exposure to violence in the same way or in a similar way to how the lung processes being exposed to TB to produce more of it, or the intestine produces more of cholera in order to have diarrhea pathology and then other people to get it. So we even know the brain pathology. So we've summarized this in an Institute of Medicine paper in 2012, but we began treating this like a contagious disease in the year 2000 and with what is now called Cure Violence. And we've been getting, and this is in many cities now, results of between 40% and 70% drops in shootings and killings.
So I was just going to ask you if you can explain a bit how this works. Obviously, you know, one of the differences is if you go into a country that is experiencing some sort of a biological disease, you administer vaccines, hopefully, and that will be part of the cure. What do you do specifically on the ground as part of Cure Violence?
Well, the starting point for this is, you know, that, and this has been kind of the headline, not exactly stated, is that of the show so far, is that, you know, in other words, violence is a health problem. And so whatever we were thinking about before in terms of this being bad people and so on, requiring punishment is like an old idea at this point. We now really understand that the people who are doing this have a health problem, that their brains and their psychological systems have been set up in this way. So what do? Well, for each infectious or contagious disease, there's something different depending on the tools that we have. And in fact, this one is a lot like Ebola in a way, because we don't have vaccine and we don't have antimicrobial therapy. What we have is changing of behavior. And so what we do is we, like we do for any contagious process where behavior is at the root of it, we hire credible messengers, health workers, and we put health workers out there to talk to people about the behavior that they're doing, to interrupt events, and to prevent the spread of it. And if we find the people who have the credibility and trust, and they're trained in the methods of detecting people who are likely to do it, and then being able to cool them down, persuade them, and then change behavior. And we're doing this in a very systematic way with a lot of specificity to it, not randomness. In other words, we're looking for very hard for who is likely to do an event next, and you know whether there's going to be knock-on events, you know, as for Ebola, as for violence. Then we get very quickly drops and reversals of the standard epidemic violence that most of the cities in the U.S. are struggling with.
One thing that's interesting about that, Hank Schwartz, is I know your hospital, all the hospitals in Connecticut, although we did not have cases of Ebola here in Connecticut, everyone essentially stopped in America in the healthcare field and said, we need to look very seriously at our protocols for what might happen if someone comes in from West Africa, maybe presenting with something like Ebola. And that's something that for this incredibly unlikely problem, we just stopped, spent a lot of money, and changed things. But we have violence coming into Hartford Hospital, into St. Francis Hospital, into Yale New Haven Hospital every single day, and we don't make the same sort of stop. There's something to that, I think, from what Gary says.
Well, absolutely. I think we have not fully adopted the public health model for addressing the problem. So I think it would be difficult for hospitals to jump to this. If you think about it, much of the expense of hospitals leaping to prepare for Ebola has been covered either by the state or the federal government. There would be no mechanism for that right now, since we're not yet defining violence in this public health sort of way. So it's both it would require a conceptual shift, and then if we actually could get into the conceptual shift, a financial public policy shift to bring us in this direction. But I think this approach is brilliant. When you think about how much of the epidemic in urban violence is impulsive violence, using the suicide model, if you just take the means of suicide away from the person, from that critical five-minute period of impulse, it really can make a difference. I believe that this can and does make a difference.
I want to quickly go to the phone. Cheryl's in West Hartford. Hi, Cheryl. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks. I just wanted to add something to the conversation about mass shooters and their motivations. I know someone who was hospitalized for thinking about mass murder, although he didn't actually commit it. And what he said was that what he was motivated by wasn't so much the sense of powerlessness, although of course there was that, but that it was the only way he could come up with to express the level of pain that he was in. And that it wasn't exactly narcissism or solipsism so much as that, as far as he was concerned, life was painful and meaningless. And so what was the difference if he killed people or not killed people? It fits with what you're speakers have been saying, but I just wanted to add that it was a slightly different take on the same question.
I think it's an important take, Cheryl. Thank you for that, Hank.
Well, I just say that I understand that. I've interviewed some folks who are in that position, but that the belief that life is so painful and so worthless that it doesn't make a difference, so why not kill the next person, is, in fact, a solipsistic belief, because what's missing in that equation is value of the life of the other. That value is not there, suggesting that others don't play a very significant role at that point in the individual's life.
Gary Slutkin, before we run low on time, I'm wondering how we get to a nationwide ideal like the one that you're talking about, where we actually begin to view violence, specifically gun violence, as some sort of a public health issue as opposed to just a criminal justice issue.
Well, it's not even opposed to. It's really it's almost instead of. And I sometimes when I speak about this, I realize that I'm trying to tell you that a whale is a mammal, because it gives live birth and you know, suckles its young and is warm-blooded. But the violence is a health problem because the people who are doing it have picked up this matter through their brain processes and are unconsciously imitating, and because, and we haven't talked about this so much directly, they've been traumatized. So the health sector needs to step up. And the, as Dr. Schwartz says, this it's the conceptual change that we need to make, and it's the resource. Right now, a lot of health departments are doing this, but not to the scale that's needed. Baltimore is very interesting, as Dr. Webster mentioned. Baltimore is going up in killings, but in the areas where the Safe Streets model, the cure violence approach is being used, they've had three communities that have had two with a year without a killing and one with 250 days. I mean, they've almost flatlined the violence in the areas where the health approach is being used. And now in the areas where it did go up, they're starting to put the health approach in. But although health directors in New York and Baltimore and Kansas City are starting to do this, the federal government doesn't have money in the health pots. All the money is in these other arenas and other sectors. So we've got to get federal, state, and city money in, as Dr. Schwartz was pointing out, and let and it. But it's going to have to follow our understand an entirely different theory. Now, the reason we have not been succeeding as much as we can is because the theory has not been right. The theory of bad people is not correct. The theory of this as a health problem, an epidemic, contagious problem, is now proven. And the Institute of Medicine has really stamped it in this way in their 2012 report. It's been written, violence is a contagious disease. The fact that one thing leads to another, the fact that trauma leads to likelihoods of hyperreactivity, the fact that people imitate, not just in gang violence, but in these mass shootings, but also in suicides. This is behaving exactly like an infectious disease, so it's the health sector now that needs to get activated and come into gear. And then we'll get better results as a country.
Dr. Schwartz, we just have 1 minute, but I'd love your final thoughts.
We just have to note that we still have a nearly complete congressional ban on research about gun violence. And that ban, even though President Obama has, by executive order, tried to circumvent it, is really standing in the way of our learning about all the public health implications and being able to make that conceptual and resource shift.
And it's not a new ban. This is a ban that has been imposed for decades now, really. And so it's been impossible to gather the sorts of data that you, Gary Slutkin, and other researchers need.
That's correct. It stands right in the middle of the road between our making this shift from a law enforcement model and a bad person model to a public health model.
I want to thank Gary Slutkin, who's founder and executive director of Cure Violence. He's a professor of epidemiology and international health at the University of Illinois at Chicago School of Public Health. He joined us by phone today. Thank you, sir, for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Dr. Hank Schwartz. He's psychiatrist in chief at Hartford Hospital's Institute of Living and vice president of behavioral health at Hartford Healthcare. Always good to see you. Sorry we always have to talk about these difficult issues, but I'm glad that you were able to come in and give us some of this insight today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Our program today was produced by Betsy Kaplan with Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, and Josh Nalea. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Tolarski. Our interns are Deborah Timms, Zachary LaSala, Amanda Gallagher, and Nate Gagnon. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.